Welcome to Stuff You Learn with Luke, with your host, Luke Farmer. Thank you for joining us on Stuff You Learn with Luke. We wanted to give a little bit of a background on how this podcast came to be. It started out that I've noticed that most agricultural podcasts can pertain to either the big commodity commercial farmers or the small homesteaders. But a huge percentage of farmers in North America, especially, work full-time jobs off-farm, but also run lucrative and high-production businesses as farmers. But it felt like there was a missing key to showing these people and profiling these people and helping them get education that helps them grow their farms. And so we started this podcast. I was fortunate enough to have this first interview with a really phenomenal farmer from the Rainy River District. And you'll notice at the beginning of this podcast, I don't have to have a lot of input as he runs with introducing himself and explaining his operation right off the bat. I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, my name is Bill Darby, and my wife's name is Deb Cornell, and for 27 years we have run Rainy River Elk Company, which is in the township of La Valley in the Rainy River District. So one might wonder, and I often get asked, why elk? Well, it's kind of a long story, but I was trained as a biologist, but always had an interest in farming. I got that from my uncle, who had a dairy farm down near Bradford in southern Ontario, and I used to help out in the summertime there and just loved it. And so when we bought our farm in 89, that was 160 acres, it was mostly hay and some grain. And so we grew hay and grain for a few years and learned that it's pretty difficult to make any amount of money on 160 acres with hay and grain. So we thought, well, we should diversify. And Deb's brother, Doug, was an ag rep in Alberta, and he was encouraging us to look at elk as a livestock. Well, I had been trained on caribou and white-tailed deer and moose, did some work with moose. And so Deb and I went to 22 different elk farms to check this out before we took the plunge. Oh, and wow. We liked what we saw, and I thought, well, if anybody should be able to farm elk, I should be able to. And Deb, of course, is an expert at marketing. She managed the Fort Francis Farmers Market for many years, and we both had a background in customer service. I was first a biologist and then supervisor and then district manager with the Ministry of Natural Resources in Fort Francis. And Deb worked with the lands department, but also then worked for a surveyor in town. So we think we can do this. So that's how we started.
So had you come from a farming background? Did you grow up on a farm?
No, not technically not. No, okay. I helped out on my uncle's dairy farm, but that was it.
Okay. And Deb, you did.
Yes, right? I did. On a beef farm.
Okay.
Right across the road from us.
Yeah. All right. And so you moved into elk. You said you had worked for Ministry of Resources.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you were still working for them when you started into elk?
I was. Okay. Yes, I was. And, you know, I got a clearance from the deputy minister that I, you know, was not considered a conflict of interest. And so we started out just with 20 bred heifers that we got from a farmer down in Owen Sound.
Okay.
and a bull from Saskatchewan up near Yorkton. So we had put up two paddocks of 8-foot fence initially, and then over time we just kept expanding that. But the basic design that we used was there's a central circle of gates, and all the paddocks link into that central circle like pieces of pie.
Right.
And we always had it in mind that, you know, it's going to make it very easy to move them from one paddock to another.
Yeah.
We had small pens, by small I mean 100 feet by 100 feet, that we would draw them into for their grain.
Okay.
And we'd pail feed through the fence into wooden troughs. So we just called them in for their grain, shut that gate, and opened the gate into the paddock where we wanted them to go.
Right.
And that served us very well over the years.
My parents traveled the world in the 60s, and they spent time in Australia and New Zealand. And I remember my dad saying they did that with sheep. Sheep and dairy cattle in New Zealand. They'd bring them in. Their milking system was in a center like that, and they'd run those pie section type pens. Yeah. And that's how they rotationally grazed all their dairy cattle, he said.
Well, we bought our elk in 95, and we started out with the 20 bred heifers and a bull, like I said. And so initially, you know, it was just try to build the herd.
Right.
We weren't getting a lot of revenue initially.
Yeah.
It was mostly expense. But once we got to the point where, like, our main meat source turned out to be yearling bulls.
Right.
That we didn't want to keep for breeding. And also, basically, anything that was small.
Yeah, yeah.
I was breeding for a larger type of elk, and so if there were small females or, you know, small bulls, well, they supplied our meat.
Right.
And that all worked pretty well. Once we got going, initially we were selling live animals.
Okay.
For example, the first few years, we were selling elk calves.
Okay.
Down in Minnesota at auctions. And once we got more older bulls, trophy bulls, old enough to be trophy, on the farm, we sold some trophy bulls to the States as well.
Okay.
And so that was working pretty well for us.
There must have been some hoops to jump through to take them internationally.
Yeah, mostly health and government inspection and forms.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, you had to have a broker. You had to have a U.S. Fish and Wildlife import-export license.
Okay.
You had to fill out a bunch of different forms, and bottom line was the way that all turned out was the broker would have me fill everything out and put it in his filing cabinet in the customs office.
Yeah.
So Bill was already a bureaucrat, so.
Yeah, I was used to doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, working with the government. You're
it
used
didn't
to that
bother
kind of
me.
Thing, yeah.
That all ended
in 2003 with a single dairy cow in Alberta and tested positive for BSE.
Yep.
Well, everything in our revenue ground to a screeching halt because they closed the border to all ruminants, not just dairy cattle, elk, even elephants. Zoos couldn't move animals. Yeah. And so that was a tough year.
Yeah.
That and the following year. Because, for example, we kept about 50 cows. And we'd have about 50 calves or close to it. A few die from the hot weather or injuries. And so we'd usually wind up with about 45 calves. And so the first year I thought, well, this isn't going to last very long. And we bred. We had the 45 calves. And then the next year was still going on. And the question is, well, are we going to breed again? Well, how long can this last? Surely.
That was a long
storm. In another year, it'll be gone.
Yeah.
So we bred a second time. And I didn't have any sale for the calves. And then we realized, oh my Lord, We got 90 extra animals here.
Yeah.
Which puts us over carrying capacity on the farm, given we already had, like at one point, I had 80 bulls.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so then I didn't breed for 1 year. And the second year, I think I only bred half the cows.
Okay.
Because we had to get things back into balance.
Right.
And that was the impetus for us to get into the meat business more seriously.
Yeah.
And I'm just very lucky that Deb was very familiar with marketing meat and was an excellent marketer. And so we started to develop a number of different products. The usual, you know, strip loin, ribeye, sirloin steaks, but and tenderloin, but a variety of different cuts. Like we had prepackaged stew meat and
right.
However, we wanted to broaden that too, and we worked with the Mennonite food processors down in southern Ontario.
Okay,
and they ferment meat to produce a cold smoked summer sausage.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So we engaged them to produce that for us, but also we said, I'd like to try like the little snack stick.
Yeah, like version pepperettes. Yeah.
Well, they turned out to be really tasty.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we had 2 packs and we had 10 packs and we soon realized that they were moving pretty well.
Yeah. Well, even I can remember buying them at different places in Thunder Bay at one point. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, when you talk about getting into farming, you have to go in with a realistic vision that this is not going to be easy.
Right. Yeah.
Like, our experience in those years was we would make 4% to 10% net revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on $200,000 of revenue,
yeah,
that's still only $8,000 to $20,000.
Yeah. Pretty hard to live on that.
Pretty hard to raise a family on that kind of money.
Yeah.
We were fortunate that, you know, I had an outside job which kind of paid the bills for our food and house. And that allowed us to continue to build equity.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, some of the expenses were buying equipment too, right? And
yeah,
it goes into the capital cost allowance. But we gradually were able to get bigger. And it was easier when we got bigger. Like, we were keeping about 150 elk after calving.
Okay.
And by the time we get around to May or June of the next year, we'd be down to 100.
Okay.
Now that would include the breeding cows, the calves that I was keeping for meat supply.
Right.
So the yearlings.
Essentially backgrounding, like you would in
the beef industry. And the bulls.
Okay.
We also had a revenue stream from the velvet antler from the bulls.
Oh, yeah, I never would have thought.
Because it was harvested, usually May and June is when we'd harvest that. And that was done, you know, under vet supervision and with a lidocaine freezing around the base of the antlers. It was actually pretty quick and easy. And our antler was sold bulk frozen to Hong Kong.
Okay.
Through a buyer in Calgary.
So then what do they use the velvet for?
Well, see, elk velvet antler has some interesting medicinal properties.
Yeah.
It has 2 types of growth hormone. It's called insulin-like growth factors 1 and 2.
Right.
And it has other things that are good for arthritis, like chondroitin sulfate and glucosamine and pantocrine. And in the Oriental pharmacies, they usually have different trays of various herbs, all prepared for use in recipes.
Okay.
And they take, you know, 10 grams of this or 2 grams of that and mix it. And, well, they'd have a tray that's dried elk velvet antler, too.
Yeah.
Okay. And mix it according to their recipes. And so that was pretty steady market for us.
Right.
But volatile.
I mean, the sale was reliable, but the price was subject to international and world politics. It would go up and down.
Yeah.
And that was kind of frustrating. But anyway, it was another revenue stream. And so, I have said since, you know, if I had to do it all over again, all I would do is make the elk snack sticks.
Yeah.
The two packs.
Yeah.
And I'd engage...
be the elk version of Jack Link's beef jerky.
Yeah. I'd engage a distributor. I'd use labeled bags. Our processor was packing the bags and vacuum packing them.
Yeah.
And if the distributor just picked up the product in boxes from the processor, we wouldn't even have to handle it.
Right.
We used herb transport a lot.
Okay.
And, you know, if I was going to do it again, I think I'd pursue that. But because it had a 40% profit margin.
Okay.
Best of any of our products.
Yeah.
And, well, you know, after we learned that, we were trying to put more meat through those. And we did expand those sales a lot, but not... You know, we continued to deal with the other products.
Right.
So that was a bit of a lesson.
And we talked about this the other day, but when you started processing, you were hauling to Dryden.
That's right.
And that's, what, 2.5 hours from
here? Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we'd have to be there at 8 a.m, so you'd have to get up early and go up the Dryden Highway with a load of elk. And then you'd have to go back 3 days later to get the carcasses when they had chilled enough.
Yeah.
And I had bought a refrigerated trailer. And so we went back and forth for quite a while, quite a few years. And then there was interest, especially because of the BSC problems.
Right.
There was interest from the beef farmers in the district in getting a local abattoir. So I participated in a committee to start and build that, and I even served 6 years as secretary and 6 years as president. We used a lot of volunteer help, too. Like, I killed for a whole year.
Okay.
As a volunteer.
Yeah.
But we got it going, and it's still going,
so,
and I'm proud of that.
I guess my other question about hauling them to Oxdrift, when you were kind of the only guy in this area doing elk, had they dealt with elk there before you started going? Or was probably. That a learning curve for everybody?
Probably, because Eggleys were up there.
Oh, right. They
and,
had.
And, well, yep. Eggleys were after, weren't they? Because we sold...
We sold some breeding stock to Eggleys early on.
But they must have handled bison.
I don't know if they ever handled bison. I mean, maybe they put them down in the trailer, but they weren't equipped to handle bison. Unless it was... Well, I wouldn't want to do it. Not with their facility, but it served our purposes. And you see, Kim... Deb's brother was Cornell Farms across the road because they have beef. He was getting into the meat business too and was slaughtering steers and cull cows. And so as it turned out, what I'd do is I'd haul up half a load of elk and half a load of beef.
Okay.
And similarly coming back with the trailer.
Interesting ride.
Well, it was
interesting to load.
Actually, the elk are pretty easy to haul.
The elk would go in the back, right?
Yeah.
Cattle would already be in there. Yeah.
That was going to be my question, is if you put the elk or the cattle on first, because
I
would be worried whether
the
cattle would think if they
were
getting
heavier,
in there and the elk
so
were already there.
Yeah, you want the wheat in the front.
Right, yeah, that makes sense.
And, yeah, so cattle went on first.
Interesting. So then, and you were working, so you worked in the ministry. How long, when did you retire from the ministry, or did you?
2009.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you were able to kind of focus on being
a
full-time farmer, which is what all of our dream is, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I would not have even attempted it without Deb.
Yeah.
I mean, we essentially split the workload. Deb took care of all the marketing and sales.
Right.
And I took care of production. But it is a lot of travel.
Yeah.
Because, we're so isolated in this part of Ontario that we're a long ways from market.
Yeah. Ontario, most of Ontario doesn't even know we exist up here.
Right.
Well, and us selling out coincided with the expansion of farmers markets around the region, too.
Right.
You know, Sulacoat, Kenora. Yeah.
So Deb and Kim would travel together, and Kim had a aluminum cargo trailer that he'd have a bunch of plug-in freezers in, and so they would go to Kenora, Sulacoat, and we had a booth at the Thunder Bay Farmers Market. We each had booths.
Yeah.
And often Red Lake as well. Okay. So it was a lot of days on the road, and that's the part actually that Deb got most tired of.
Yeah, I believe it. Yeah.
Was all the travel.
Yeah. I can feel that one. With traveling with shoe and horses, I can feel that. Yeah.
But it worked for us.
My knees didn't like it anymore.
Yeah.
But, you know, we had one young lady who worked for us and was a very good employee. And she was kind of curious. She was asking me, so what about succession? Are you thinking you might sell the farm or the elk?
That is one of my questions. Did you have a farm succession plan, or do you have a farm succession plan? Or?
Well, we did not. And our daughters, both of whom were a big help on the farm and quite enjoyed it, still, they wound up in their own professional career paths.
Right.
And one's in Thunder Bay and the other's in Toronto. And so, you know, life takes you in different directions, and it was quite clear that they weren't going to come back and take over the farm because they're making too much money in the jobs they're in.
Right. Yeah.
And this young lady was interested, and I said to her, I would just love to work with you and develop a changeover plan.
Right.
But I'll be blunt with you. To make enough money to support a family, I'd have to have an elk herd that's twice as big.
Yeah.
Because we're doing all this work, and by the time you figure out the proper percentage, and, you just have to move more animals.
Yeah.
And that's the daunting reality. And she wisely thought, maybe I don't want to take that on.
Well, and that's a very long trickle effect, right? Because then you get down into that realm of where not only do you have to move more animals, but you have to make sure you've got space in an abattoir that's going to be willing to kill, and cooler space to store. And
well, even with the size of your equipment, I have a 9-foot hay bine, and I've got an old John Deere baler,
right,
and a rake that just works well with those windrows. And Everson matches.
Yeah.
But if I want to cut hay faster and get a big disc bine, all of a sudden I need a bigger rake, I need a bigger baler, and on it goes.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. Now, so my next question, though, is you were working off-farm, you were building quite a lot going on, really building your farm and building an abattoir, and how did you find time, or how did you go about balancing work with farm and finding time to spend with family?
Deb's father one day said to her, "Why is Bill always working in the dark?" That's why.
Same thing happens at my place, yeah.
But the kids, I have to say, essentially, I don't remember any real complaints about working on the farm. You know, they helped in all aspects, whether it was checking animals during calving or driving tractor during haying. you know, both our girls found themselves very employable as young women because they had lots of skills, right?
Right.
And so we did a lot of family time on the farm. It may have been working, doing farm things, but we always squeezed some time out to do some camping, you know, fishing. A bit of traveling, fishing, so...
Yeah. So, and talk about working in the dark, that's one of the things that we are constantly dealing with, and it's... My girls are pretty involved in extracurricular sports with school. And so there's lots of nights we're not getting home till 9:30, 10 o'clock. We still have to do turn-in and with our horses and feed cattle, and I'm out there on a tractor in the dark and the snow and getting it done, and sometimes not getting in till 1 a.m., but if that's what it takes, it's what it takes to be able to be involved, right? So
Yeah. Rebecca was just... Our niece was just talking yesterday about having a veterinarian day away from the farm and then coming home and finding a sick calf and it was a calf sick enough she had to bring it into the barn and she talked about it being a midnight night.
Yeah. You learn to kind of run on no sleep.
You know, I guess, you know, with farming, most of us do it though by choice.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's something the job we choose because of the salary it offers. You know, it offers physical activity. It offers being outdoors. It offers, you know, working with animals. There's lots of...
It's a passion.
Yeah. There's lots of positive things that you get from... living rurally and farming.
Okay.
You know, another thing that makes it worthwhile farming, at least on a small scale like we did, I really enjoyed working with the elk.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not only a pretty animal, and I wasn't putting a lot of emphasis on pretty, but I respect them and their evolutionary background. And they evolved on the aspen parkland of the prairies in North America. And that's exactly what our farm is. It's aspen parkland.
Right.
And so things that really pleased me were I'd go up the laneway to the handling barn and the pens where I fed grain in the morning and the wooden troughs. And I'd go up there with the four-wheeler, and I'd have a whole bunch of pails of grain in the back in a little trailer. Well, I'd have, just on the other side of the fence, right near me, I'd have 95 cows and calves running as fast as they could go up the laneway beside me.
Yeah.
And that was always fun, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. I
really enjoyed that. And just working with the bulls and... you get to know the behavior of the animals very well.
And that must have been a learning curve, though, a bit.
A bit.
Coming into a different commodity that no one else was doing. You didn't really have someone local that you could call upon when you had questions, right? So.
No, but I had enough experience in the biology of critters like moose to realize the risks.
Right.
Like, cow elk are very defensive of their young calves.
Right.
And they can really kick with their front feet.
Oh, I can imagine, yeah.
And so, you know, essential part of elk handling equipment was the big club.
Okay.
That's so defensive.
Yeah. So now, aside from running your farm and raising family, did you have any involvement with some of the youth organizations like 4-H or Young Farmers or any of those?
Well, I was on the OFA board for a while.
Okay.
And I spoke to 4-H groups a couple of times, like their annual awards night, that kind of thing.
Right.
Stewardship Rangers.
But no, I wasn't involved with the youth groups on a regular basis.
Okay.
Stewardship Rangers came out every year, though.
So, stewardship rangers.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
like the Ministry of Natural Resources said an Ontario Stewardship Ranger Program.
Okay.
And it was taken over by one of the local First Nation groups.
Okay.
And so through the summer, they'd have young students participate as stewardship rangers because there'd be a whole bunch of different projects that they would do. So they'd volunteer their time and come and help whoever was heading up the project.
Right.
And, you know,
they must have been a couple of
times, two or three times they came out and when I had a fencing project.
Okay, yeah.
And I showed them how you have to build a proper fence.
So there's a question I'm going to circle back around to. I mean, I've driven by the farm. I see what you've got for fences, and they're what? Are they 8 foot, 9 foot?
Yeah, 8 foot.
So are there regs? Does the government have regs
just
for that if you're raising
elk? You have to have that kind of fence to farm elk.
Okay.
But no, there's no suite of regulations. The way the government handles it in Ontario is, if they get out, you have to recover them.
Okay.
Within a reasonable period of time. And if you don't, they'll hire a helicopter and shooters and go and shoot them, and you have to pay for all that.
Okay, yeah.
Well, that's a pretty strong incentive.
Yeah, to have good fences.
To have good fences and be careful with your gates and all that thing. Well,
good fences make good neighbors, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Let me see here now. Just make sure I've covered kind of most of my questions, I think. I do have a few kind of quick answer questions, and it's okay if you want to elaborate on them, and they're not necessarily all farm related, but tractor or equipment brand, what would you pick?
Well, I am married into a family that used to be Massey Ferguson dealers. You know, up until a few years ago, it wasn't permitted to have a green piece of equipment on the farm. But then Kim made a deal to get a big 8-wheel John Deere for trading some heifers.
Yeah.
So now it's okay to have green.
Yeah. I always say I don't have green because I can't afford green paint, so...
I have a 120 horsepower tractor and it's actually a row crop tractor, but those low gears have helped me at times when I'm doing fine work.
Yes.
Especially like stretching a fence.
Yeah.
And that 120 horse with the loader has been just the right tractor for my operation.
Yeah, it's a nice size to have. Favorite book? Or do you have a favorite book?
Oh, now you're really testing me. Well, I'm kind of a history buff.
Yeah.
So, you know, and Pierre Burton was such a prolific author on all things historical in Canada that he's kind of my favorite author.
Okay. Travel journals? You like travel journals?
Yeah, like, you know, I've got a lot of memoirs and journals of explorers and fur traders and... you know, just even with the Riel Rebellion, and there's all kinds of books.
Yeah.
And original text that's very interesting to read.
I read a really interesting book. I don't know if I had told you about that before, but it it chronicles the Lewis and Clark expedition. It's called Undaunted Courage. And they follow a lot of Meriwether Lewis's journals all the way through. It kind of chronicles mostly his life, but it's a super interesting book. Like I said, I do a ton of windshield time, so I listened to it in an audiobook, but it was like a 18, 19-hour book. It was great. Covered a lot of miles with that one.
Yeah.
Good idea.
Yeah.
They covered a lot of territory, and they had a lot of original information about the native... groups.
Yeah.
You know.
So one of the ones that I was telling my veterinarian this a few weeks back, we were gelding a colt, and I was saying that what I learned in that book was it was, and I can't tell you what indigenous tribe it was, but they spent a winter with on that expedition, and that's where they changed the way we castrate colts. Because up until then, they had always stitched the incisions back up. And the indigenous culture was just pulling them out and clamping them off and then letting them drain. And he did studies on it that winter, castrating colts both ways, and found that their method was far superior, and that's how we castrate colts to this day.
Is that right?
Yeah. Huh. Favorite inspirational quote? Do you have one?
Inspirational book?
Inspirational quote.
Oh. I don't have one.
Winston Churchill. You know, I mean, he had remarkable phrases where he could capture the whole struggle of the people.
Yeah.
But one of the things was, when you're going through hell, just keep going.
Yeah. I like that one. It's good, yeah.
Sounds familiar.
You sort of answered this already, but your farm organization of choice was OFA?
Yes.
Ontario Federation of Agriculture.
Yes.
Yeah. Favorite drink?
Scotch.
There you go. I like that. Yeah. And truck brand?
Well, you know, I've had GMs and I've had Fords.
Presently.
The last one, I've had a Dodge Ram for quite a while now, and it's been a darn good truck. Zero maintenance.
Yeah, that's
good. You know, except for regular wear and tear.
But you'll just drive a truck. You don't care what it is, really.
Not really. Yeah. I mean, I was a diesel man, but then, holy man, as diesels became more complicated, they also became more troublesome.
Yeah.
And I found, like, I had a Ford 1-ton. Holy man, I was spending way more per month keeping that thing on the road than a truck payment.
Yeah.
So it's parked back at the farm, still there. And I just bought a good used. And it's a gas. And I knew it would be a gas guzzler.
Yeah.
But I've had no maintenance costs other than ball joint, wheel bearing, U-joint.
Yeah. Which you're going to have in any vehicle as you put miles on them, right?
Yes.
So now you guys have, I mean, you've sold your elk out. You've
downsized completely. Yeah, we sold in 2 summers ago, so.
So what's next?
Well,
more time to travel.
Last year I bought a bunch of steer calves in the fall.
Right.
And that's 2 years ago. And we raised them for a year, and I sold them at the sale last September. And we did quite well on those steers.
Well, beef prices have been good for the last couple of years, right?
Yeah, I made 67% profit.
Oh, nice.
And very I nice. Thought, why were we farming alcohol? But, you know, beef, just like with other commodities, the price is up and down. And, you know, I didn't buy more calves at the time because their prices were pretty high.
Right.
And I was lucky that I'd bought when the price was low. So I thought, I better be careful. Meantime, like this summer, I'll have the farm growing grass like crazy. And, I'm looking to make a grazing deal with somebody.
Okay.
Because I got an underground water system, goes to all the paddocks.
Right. Good. Well, thank you very much for sitting down with me. And
you're quite welcome.
We will.
Thank you for listening to Stuff You Want with Luke. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I enjoyed creating it. If you want to keep up to date for the next episode, follow me on Instagram at Stuff You Learn with Luke, or on TikTok at Stuff You Learn with Luke. Until next time, this is Stuff You Learn with Luke.